He located the macerate pump and outboard dump handle, turned it 90 degrees, and opened it to the outside elements. He loosened the hose clamp to ensure that the first big wave the yacht hit would free the hose completely, which meant the craft would start taking on water and begin her journey to the bottom of the ocean. He made his way to the circuit breaker and flipped the one labeled bilge to prevent the bilge pump from pumping water. With a non-floatable hull, it was unlikely to pump water out faster than the 48-foot craft would take it on, but Reese wanted to be sure. He then unscrewed the throughput and scampered topside. Reese killed the red light and pulled the elastic strap on the headlamp so it dangled around his neck. The inflatable launch was tied alongside the port side of the Bitter Harvest, protecting it from the prevailing winds and mild seas that lapped along the starboard edge of the hull. He shouldered his pack and secured the bump helmet to his head. Lowering the dual lenses of his NODs, the world turned green and the immediate space brightened significantly. He lowered his Sitka gear duffel into the launch and took one last look around the deck before swinging himself over the railing, his bare feet landing on the rigid deck of the Zodiac Mark II GR below. Reese pumped the primer bulb and set the choke before cranking the motor. It took three tries before it caught, and he let it idle for a full minute to warm it up. Satisfied that it wasn't going to stall at the wrong moment, he untied the bow and stern lines from the Bitter Harvest's cleats and drifted away from the boat that had been his only home for the past 14 weeks. As he advanced the throttle, the bow lurched skyward, obscuring his view of the shoreline in the distance. He kept the speed to a minimum, just enough to stay on plane. He wasn't in a rush, and there was no sense in making any unnecessary engine noise. He assumed it was too early to encounter any fishing vessels, and he didn't know if his destination nation had a navy or even a coast guard patrolling its waters. After 16 years in the teams, Reese felt perfectly comfortable in a small boat headed toward the coastline of a foreign land that wasn't expecting his arrival, though he did silently long for a couple of armed teammates, some fresh intel, and perhaps a map. He had debated whether to steer the Bitter Harvest to within a mile of shore and simply swim in from that distance, but given that his only exercise over the past several weeks had been operating the sailboat, he wasn't sure he was physically up for it. Also, given the lack of intel about potential coastal patrols, he preferred the decreased signature that the Zodiac gave him. As he steered the boat and scanned the horizon, he inflated the small dive vest around his neck using the plastic tube attached to the front. The spray of salt water that soaked him felt good against his skin in the warm night air. It took 20 minutes to close the distance to where Reese planned to make his approach, approximately 500 meters offshore. He carefully scanned the sandy beach and dark waters for any sign of activity. Seeing nothing concerning, he swung his legs over the side and entered the 80-degree water while keeping a firm grip on the inflatable hull, his vest helping support his head above the waves. He had lined the inside of his duffel with garbage bags to render it effectively waterproof, which also made it buoyant. His NODs quickly fogged, thanks to the water, body heat, and humidity, and he pushed them up onto the helmet and out of his way. He didn't need to see much other than the white sand of the beach at this point anyway. He unclipped the Winkler folding knife from the waistband of his board shorts with his right hand, locking the blade with a flick of his thumb, before methodically stabbing each section of the sponson tubes, turning the workhorse craft into a flooded mess. Weighed down by the 35-horsepower outboard motor, the craft quickly sank into the black water. Pushing his floating duffel ahead of him, Reese kicked toward Mozambique. The beach was deserted. Reese had aimed for the darkest spot on the horizon during his approach, and as his feet made landfall for the first time in ages, he made his way onto a stretch of coastline devoid of structures. He paused in chest-deep water, slowly scanning the shoreline in front of him with his NODs, looking for any movement. The glow of an ill-timed cigarette break, or sharp edges to shapes that might signify something man-made. Satisfied his approach was clear, he waded ashore. He had thought he might feel an urge to kneel in thanks like some conquistador who had just discovered the new world, but oddly enough, he felt like he was coming home. Reese moved as quickly as the soft white sand would allow toward the tree line ahead. As he entered the scrub vegetation, he opened the duffel and reached into the back pocket of his pack to remove his Glock from the freezer bag that had protected it during his one-man over-the-beach operation. He then sat quietly, pistol in hand, for 10 minutes, letting his senses get in tune with his new terrestrial environment. It took about 30 seconds for the mosquitoes to discover his presence, and he endured scores of bites as he struggled not to move. Satisfied that no one was aware of his arrival, he reached back into his duffel and tore through the garbage bag liner. He stripped off his vest and traded his soaked T-shirt for a dry one, using his wet shirt to clean the sand from his feet before putting on socks and lightweight Salomon trail runners. Seal or not, Reese was not a fan of sandy feet. Digging a hole with the help of a nearby rock as a spade, he dropped in his vest and dirty, wet shirt. He then removed his NODs and helmet, giving them one last look. He needed to travel light, and being caught with ITAR-restricted night vision might complicate his story as just another backpacker wandering the earth in search of the meaning of life. Not the greatest backstory, and not much to support it except for the long hair, beard, and lack of personal hygiene, which just might be enough. Looking down at his M4, he whispered a quick goodbye as he wrapped it and his NODs in trash bags from the boat and cached them as best he could in the ground, brushing over the area with a dry limb. Though it didn't fit his thin backstory, he couldn't bring himself to cache his Glock. It wouldn't do much against many of the larger animals of the African bush, but it would be more than sufficient against the two-legged variety. Be prepared. Noting the exact position of the cache on his GPS, Reese stood and began the next phase of his journey. Chapter 17. Managua, Nicaragua, December 1991. Over the ensuing weeks since their unlikely encounter on the beach, Gray and Andrenov met regularly. Their photographic journeys took them away from the city and into the villages and hinterlands of this nation not far removed from the conflict between the Sandinistas and Contras. There was still a sizable U.S. presence in Nicaragua, but engagement was cautious at best after the fallout from the Iran-Contra affair. It was no coincidence that these remote locations kept them from the prying eyes of U.S. counterintelligence agents and chance encounters with other embassy personnel that would require explanation. Gray enjoyed the companionship and the ability to speak freely in his mother's native tongue. He knew he was being assessed and recruited, of course, but like a lonely spouse who wasn't getting enough attention at home, he enjoyed being on the receiving end of the chase. For the first time in his life, he felt wanted. Andrenov believed in him and trusted him to be the spy the CIA didn't think he could be. When the ask came, there was no great philosophical pitch or movie theatrics. It was simply a favor from one friend to another. Gray was scheduled to return to Langley, and Andrenov asked if he might be able to look up something for him in the archives, something personal. As a token of their friendship, Andrenov also gave Gray a gift just before he departed, his olive-green Bundeswehr-marked Leica M4. To a layperson, the camera looked like something one might pick up at a garage sale, but to a photography buff like Gray, or any auction house, it was a priceless treasure. That it was a fake, a Leica painted and engraved by the technical division of the GRU to mimic the famed collector's piece, was a fact that Gray would never discover. Upon his return to the States, Gray set about returning the favor to his newly adopted Soviet father. He found Andrenov's first request to be an odd one. He didn't ask for details of a classified weapons program or even the identities of any U.S. intelligence assets working in Russia. His request was ancient history by agency standards. The identities of the MACV-SOG team members who ambushed and killed a group of Soviet military advisors in Laos in 1971. It took some digging, but Gray found the after-action report of reconnaissance team Ozark, a mixed U.S. and South Vietnamese special operations unit attached to the Phoenix program. Led by a U.S. Navy chief petty officer, Team Ozark had been tasked with a series of cross-border missions to interdict communist supply lines along the Ho Chi Minh Trail. The team's report was among the records from the CCN compound near Da Nang, where agency and SOG personnel based many of their classified operations. Though the paper reports had been converted to microfiche and were cumbersome to sift through, Gray did his research the way he lived and worked, unnoticed by anyone. R.T. Ozark reported executing a near ambush on a three-vehicle convoy on the Laotian side of the border, killing all the enemy troops with a combination of claymore mines, 40-millimeter grenades, and small arms fire. Among the dead was a Caucasian male, dressed in the uniform of a Soviet Army officer. Chapter 18. Pemba, Mozambique, March. At first light, Reese found himself walking westward on a dirt road that ran toward the city of Pemba. The shacks and homes that lined the roadside became more frequent as he traveled, confirming that he was moving in the right direction. Within minutes of sunrise, Reese began seeing other pedestrians along his route, no doubt headed to work. Many stared wide-eyed at the strange-looking white man who'd trespassed on their morning commute, while others paid him no mind, having seen many of his adventure-seeking backpacker brethren wander through over the years. Even this early, the salty air was warm and damp, and Reese slowed his pace so as not to soak through his clothing. He'd lost so much weight during his months at sea that he had to safety pin the excess waistband of his board shorts so they didn't slide off his hips. Still, he had to pull them up every few minutes as he walked. His uphill path took him by an abandoned-looking sports complex complete with faded tennis courts and an empty soccer stadium, artifacts from the nation's colonial past. Reaching a paved two-lane road, he followed it for close to a mile until it intersected with a four-lane highway. Across the intersection was the Pemba Airport, a relatively small facility with commercial service to larger sub-Saharan locations, such as Dar es Salaam and Johannesburg. Where was Liz Riley and her plane when he needed her? He had no idea of the day's flight schedule, but expected that the early morning departures from the major destinations would be arriving shortly, with taxis likely to be queuing up to meet the passengers. Even a remote third-world airport such as this might have surveillance cameras and would definitely have a police presence. Reese had to assume that his face was plastered on every television in the world, so contact with law enforcement had to be avoided. He crossed the four lanes of traffic and began walking on a shaded path that paralleled the road toward any cabs that would be approaching the airport from the city center. Unlike in some African nations, drivers in Mozambique used the right-hand side of the road. The morning traffic mostly consisted of flatbed and stake-bodied delivery trucks, but within 10 minutes of walking, Reese saw what he was looking for. He stepped into the edge of the oncoming lane and waved his hand at the white compact sedan. The Toyota slowed, put on its turn signal, and drove slightly past him before pulling onto the road's shoulder. The driver of the King Cab Radio Taxi Toyota, a thin black man dressed in penny loafers, dark dress pants, and a threadbare button-down, stepped out to help Reese with his bags. He was obviously uncomfortable with his car's position and moved quickly to open the hatchback. Reese loaded his duffel but kept his pack as he climbed into the small back seat. Feigning an Australian accent rather poorly, Reese asked the driver to take him to an internet cafe. Reese hadn't spoken to another human since he'd left Katie and Liz on the runway at Fisher's Island. He couldn't help but wonder where they were now and if they were all right. The cab's path took it back toward the airport, where the driver made a U-turn to head toward Pemba proper. Pemba had a reputation as a refuge for mercenaries, spies, and criminals due to its remote location and minimal connection with the inept national government. The city, known as Porto Emília during Portuguese colonial rule, was both decrepit and beautiful at the same time. In some ways, it reminded Rhys of the many Caribbean islands he'd visited, where locals scratched out a destitute existence adjacent to the walls of luxury resorts catering to families who never ventured beyond their secure boundaries. The beaches here were as beautiful as anywhere on earth and were virtually undeveloped. No skyscraper condos, just a scattering of thatched roofs along the white sand. The city sat on a peninsula and would be an ideal deep-water port if Mozambique had an economy to support it. The architecture was a mix of utilitarian concrete residences, shacks, and aging Portuguese structures that highlighted the dominant influences of the world's first colonial empire. Churches represented an expeditious religious footprint to win the hearts of the indigenous population, along with the accompanying military fortifications required to win their minds. Following the high ground on the bay side of the peninsula, the driver's path into the city led them through streets crowded with more pedestrian than automotive traffic. People and vehicles moved at a laid-back pace. No one seemed to be in much of a hurry. After spending so much time alone on the open seas, he felt a bit claustrophobic in the crowded street. But a few deep breaths got things under control. The taxi stopped in front of a building in what appeared to be a shopping district, and the driver pointed to the meter, which read 462.25 MZN. "How much US, mate?" The driver smiled and held up seven fingers. "Everybody likes dollars." Rhys peeled a $10 bill from a wad of cash in the top pocket of his pack and handed it to the driver, who nodded enthusiastically. He stepped out of the cab as the driver moved to unload his duffel from the back, pointing at a storefront. Rhys nodded, looked around at his new surroundings, and headed through the propped-open double doors of the café. Inside, a tired-looking employee manned the desk, and a handful of young men occupied seats in front of a row of ancient computer terminals. The room was dimly lit, with much of the illumination coming from the computer screens. There were no overt signs of surveillance cameras. A price list in what must have been the local language and what looked like Portuguese specified the rates. Hora was surely hour, and based on the cab fare, that much time was around $5. Rhys handed the man behind the counter a $5 bill. He studied it carefully before putting it into his shirt pocket, then waved his arm toward the computers and said something that Rhys couldn't understand. The other patrons were glued to their screens and paid Rhys no attention as he moved to the computer closest to the wall. The machine was ancient, one of those Dell desktop tower PCs from the late 1990s that cost $3,000 and, a few months later, were worth about $100. The browser was an old, unsupported version of Google Chrome, and it took a full minute of clicking and whirring for the program to open after Rhys double-clicked on it. He had a strong urge to look up a few news stories related to his last days in the United States and an even stronger inclination to do a Google search for Liz and Katie, but knowing that the long arm of the NSA was likely on the lookout for just such an event, he resisted. He typed Richard Hastings Safari Operator into the browser and waited an eternity for the response. The first hit was a web page for RH Safaris, and he clicked on the link. It was obvious from the About Us section of the site that he had found the correct Richard Hastings, so he clicked on the Our Areas page. A map of the safari area eventually loaded, and he took a small notebook and pencil from his pack to take note of the location. The area was in one of the hunting blocks that bordered the Nyasa National Reserve, a vast wilderness area in northern Mozambique along the border with Tanzania. The map wasn't interactive, so Rhys made a sketch of its proximity to terrain features, including the river that bordered the safari area and the closest town of Montepuez, which is where the paved roads ended. After waiting painfully for Google Maps to load, he found the approximate location of the safari area, and instead of dropping a pin, he used the scale in the bottom right-hand corner to estimate distance. The camp was at least 5 hours from Pemba by car, and that was being generous, considering the likely condition of the roads. It was probably more like an 8-hour trip during this, the rainy season. Besides, he didn't have a car, so the point was moot. He did a search for RH Safaris, and among various links and junk results, found a trip report from a previous safari client on a hunting message board. The report described the hunter's trip down to the most minute of details, including his clothing and ammunition choices. Fortunately, this attention to detail also described the air charter service he'd used. Pemba Air Charters listed an address on Avenue de Marginal near the airport, meaning that he had walked directly past it this morning. Given the remote location of the safari area, Rhys figured the charter service likely served as a regular shuttle to and from the camp, and that the individuals involved would have a strong working relationship. Rather than trying to buy a truck or motorcycle to navigate his way to the camp while avoiding police and military, chartering a plane was course of action one. He wrote down the address and phone number before deleting the browser history and heading for the door. He nodded at the attendant and went back out into the slow-motion hustle and bustle of the coastal African city. The same Toyota taxi that had dropped Rhys off was still waiting, and the driver treated him like a long-lost brother. Currency breeds loyalty in certain parts of the world. Well, most of them anyway. Rhys handed the address to the driver, who nodded and steered the car back into traffic. A few minutes later, they were at their destination. Rhys gave the driver another 10, and this time the man handed him a business card and pointed at the phone number. "Call me if you need me again." Rhys nodded in understanding. The world headquarters of Pemba Air Charters was a faded baby blue single-family home surrounded by an iron gate with brick columns. The windows of the building were covered with burglar bars, and an older Suzuki minivan parked just inside the gate had a magnetic Pemba Air Charters logo on the door. Rhys pressed the doorbell button on the brick column and put on his best smile. The front door of the house opened, and a short, broad-chested white man wearing sandals, blue athletic shorts, and a faded olive t-shirt stepped out, squinting his eyes in the bright sunlight. He walked half the distance between the house and the gate. "Can I help you?" he asked in the heavily accented English of East Africa. "I'm looking for Pemba Air Charters. Am I in the right place?"
"You are. We just don't get many walk-ins."
He walked to the gate, fishing a key ring out of his pocket, and extended his hand.
"I'm Jeff."
"Richard Connell. Rhys to meet you," Rhys improvised.
"Come on in, Mr. Connell. It's bloody hot out here, eh?"
"Thanks, I appreciate it." Rhys followed Jeff inside. What would have been the family room of the house was set up as an office, with a desk, an office chair, and a sofa in the center of the room. He assumed that Jeff both worked out of and lived here.
"Sit your bags down anywhere. Can I get you anything? A beer?"
"No, I'm fine, thanks."
"Have a seat."
Jeff pointed at the couch as he made his way around the desk and took a seat behind it.
"American, eh?"
"More of a world traveler."
"I guess so, if you're walking around Pemba. What can we do for you?"
"I'm looking to charter a flight to the RH Safaris camp near Nyasa."
"Ah, yes, we do a good bit of work with them. You realize that it's not the hunting season, though, right?"
"I do. I'm not headed there to hunt. I am a friend of the Hastings family and thought I would visit Mr. Hastings since I was in this part of the world."
"Right." Jeff nodded skeptically. "We can help with that for sure, eh? I need to call them and make sure that someone is in camp before we put in a flight plan.
I completely understand. You can tell him that Utalivu's friend from college wants to visit.
Right. Let's give him a call then, eh?
Jeff picked up a desk phone and dialed a number from memory. 10 seconds later, the call was answered on the other end.
Hey, Bru, it's Jeff. I've got an oak here who wants to visit you. Says he's a college friend of Utalivu, whoever the fuck that is.
Jeff winked at Reese to let him know that he was joking.
Right, okay then. Let me take a look at the weather. See you soon. Need me to bring you anything?
Right. Jeff hung up the phone and looked up at Reese.
He said to bring you in as soon as possible. I'll check the weather and we'll see about getting you there today.
That's great. Thanks, Jeff. How much do I owe you?
You must be a good friend of Rich, he said to add it to his tab.
Within an hour, they were loading Reese's bags into a small truck and backing through the driveway gate. Jeff had changed into his pilot uniform and carried a black chart case, identical to the ones used by commercial pilots the world over. It took them 3 minutes to drive onto the airport grounds, and much to Reese's relief, Jeff drove around the terminal and directly onto the tarmac and stopped next to a high-wing, single-engine turboprop aircraft. The Cessna 208 Caravan could hold up to 9 passengers, but Jeff and Reese would be the only occupants on this trip. Reese loaded his bags while Jeff went to handle some business with the aviation authorities. It was too hot to sit in the plane, so Reese took a seat on the door's step and rested in the shade of the wing. Jeff returned after a few minutes and began pre-flighting the plane, instructing Reese to sit in the right seat of the cockpit. There was no sign of police or military activity at the field, but nonetheless, Reese breathed a silent sigh of relief when they were finally airborne. Chapter 19. Nyasa Game Reserve, Mozambique, Africa, March. The flight to camp took them an hour and a half, with Jeff playing the part of tour guide over the headsets as they flew. He pointed out rivers, towns, and villages along the green and brown landscape, giving Reese the lay of the land. The last town of any size before camp was Montepuez, but from the air, it looked to be nothing more than a few buildings. Jeff indicated the river that formed the boundary of the hunting area as they passed it, and it still took 10 minutes of flying to reach the runway. He had certainly chosen one of the most remote spots on the globe to come to die. Reese noticed a white pickup parked alongside the red dirt runway, which Jeff circled to approach into the wind. The pilot lowered the flaps and eased back on the throttle, dropping the Cessna on a glide path toward the earth below. The plane touched down gently and bounced along the runway until it slowed to a stop in front of the vehicle. Through the plane's windshield, Reese immediately recognized the man standing by the white Land Cruiser as Rich Hastings, Rafe's uncle and the owner of RH Safaris. He had aged quite a bit since Reese had seen him last. It was hard to believe that almost 20 years had passed since that summer in Zimbabwe. His short hair was stark white, which contrasted drastically with his deeply tanned skin. He stood more than 6 feet tall and had the lean build of an endurance athlete, the ropey veins of his muscled forearms visible below the rolled-up sleeves of his starched green safari-style shirt. He wore short shorts and sandals without socks. His face broke into a wide smile when he saw Reese descend from the plane's cabin and walked forward to meet him.
"James, good to see you, young man."
He shook Reese's hand with an iron grip and slapped him on the back with his other hand, greeting him as he would a long-lost nephew.
"Great to see you, Mr. Hastings. Thank you so much for, well, for not turning me away."
"Of course, James, you are like family. Family is always welcome, especially when they are in need."
The twinkle in his blue eyes told Reese that Mr. Hastings was well aware of his fugitive status.
"Do you have any bags I can help you with?"
"I can get them, thanks." Reese climbed into the Cessna's cabin and handed his duffel down to Richard, who was standing in the doorway. He slung his pack over one shoulder and approached the cabin to thank Jeff for the ride.
Thanks so much for getting me here, Jeff. I really appreciate it.
No worries, eh, mate? Hopefully I'll see you again. If you need a ride anywhere, Rich knows how to get hold of me. Best of luck to you.
Thanks.
The men shook hands and Reese climbed down the steps to the dirt runway. His bag was already loaded into the bed of the Land Cruiser and Rich Hastings motioned for him to get on the passenger side. The older man started the truck and pulled onto a track that led away from the runway. Reese was taking in the landscape in silence when Hastings spoke.
I'm only going to mention this once, James. Bloody awful business about your family. I read up on it. A young reporter seemed to have the inside scoop. I tried asking Rafe about it, but you know him. Elusive bastard, Hastings said with a smile while shifting gears. The reports mentioned something about brain tumors in your men?
Reese remained silent.
Well, you'll let me know if you need a doctor, eh? Then you're welcome to stay here as long as you'd like. I'd say the chances of them finding you in Mozambique are pretty slim, so long as you don't stick your head up too high.
I appreciate it, sir. I really do.
We don't get much in the way of outside news here, James. Our focus is the land and its game. I guess that's why we're all out here. The camp doesn't even have internet. All our bookings come through a hunting concierge service out of Georgia, and they call us the old-fashioned way, on the telephone. There's only one in camp, and it's in the main office. That's a big attraction for clients, actually. Here, they can forget about the modern world that has them constantly connected. No choice out here. If you want to be off the grid, this is your place.
Thank you. That suits me just fine.
You struck me as a good lad when you were here last. We won't speak of it again,
Hastings declared, pulling into the safari camp.
You look like a bloody skeleton. We've got a big dinner cooking. We'll see if we can put some meat back on those bones.
I can't wait. It has been a long time since I've had a decent meal. Or a beer.
We'll get you caught up on both, then. You can get washed up, and then we'll eat.
Camp was a series of structures made of stone, timber, mud, and thatch. There was a massive barn-like common building with an open-air dining room, bar, and seating area. A detached kitchen building sat nearby, and a series of guest cottages were strung laterally along the ridge that faced the river below. There was also a shop for maintaining the vehicles, a skinning shed, walk-in refrigerated storage, and staff quarters. Hastings led Reese down a stone path to one of the guest cottages and showed him the amenities. It was basic, but it was clean and well-maintained, and the view was amazing.
Home, sweet African home.
Reese had just enough time to get his bags situated when a polite female voice from outside his hooch told him that it was time for dinner. He headed for the bathroom to clean himself up and barely recognized the man who stared back at him in the mirror. Long, sun-bleached hair, bronze skin framing the pale white where his sunglasses had blocked the rays, a visibly broken nose from its meeting with the ship's wheel, and a beard that nearly touched his chest. His eyes were set deep by the drastic loss of body weight, the rest of his face obscured by his gray-streaked facial hair. He didn't figure on dinner being too formal in this corner of the world, but the last thing he wanted to do was offend his generous hosts. He turned on the shower and dropped his clothes to the stone floor before stepping into the stream of warm water. Nothing in his life had ever felt better. Standing still for what seemed like an eternity, he let the water wash the salt and grime from his matted hair. There were shampoo and a bar of soap on a shelf cut into the stone wall, and he lathered himself carefully, making sure to hit every inch. He stepped out of the shower feeling more human than beast and toweled dry. Using his fingers, he worked the tangles out of his wet hair, slicking it back as best he could without the benefit of a comb or brush. A toothbrush and toothpaste had been laid out for him, and after rationing toothpaste throughout his transoceanic voyage, He enjoyed the luxury of squirting a giant dollop onto his brush and scrubbing away. He found a short-sleeved white polo shirt and a pair of lightweight pants that looked to be about his size laid out on his bed when he emerged from the shower. Obviously, Rich had canvassed the camp for clothes that might fit his guest. Donning his new apparel, Reese declared himself as presentable as possible and exited into the cool evening air. He assumed that dinner would be served in the open-air dining room he'd seen on the way in, so he followed the stone path in that direction. Sure enough, he entered the massive thatched-roof living and dining area to find Hastings standing by a small bar with three younger men. Despite Reese's visions of colonial Africa, none of the men were dressed any more formally than he was. Hastings spotted Reese as he entered the room and waved him over.
"James, come, come."
He motioned toward the younger men.
"James, this is Louis, Mike, and Darren. They are my PHs here in this concession."
Anywhere else in the world they would be known as hunting guides, but in Africa they are known as professional hunters and are subject to various licensing standards. To be a PH in Mozambique, you have to meet the requirements of neighboring Zimbabwe, which had the toughest PH standards in all of Africa. These men knew their business. The three men, each at least as tall as Reese, extended their hands and greeted him warmly and politely. They looked to be in their late 20s or early 30s, and all had the same long and lean build as Hastings. They were deeply tanned with sun-beaten skin that gave them the faces of men in their 40s or 50s. These were hard men.
"What are you drinking, James? We have plenty of booze, beer, and wine."
Beer would be great, thanks."
Richard motioned to the youngest looking of the men.
"Mike, get Mr. Reese here a beer, please."
What little alcohol had been on the sailboat had been consumed in the Azores, and Reese hadn't had a drink in what seemed like an eternity. The young man handed him an ice-cold can of beer.
"Cheers, mate."
Reese took a long drink that disappeared at least half the can. He couldn't remember a better-tasting beer in his life.
"First sip is the best, eh?"
Hastings said, smiling.
"James here has had a long trip. He is a friend of my nephew, Rafe, whom you all know, and he is going to be spending as much time with us as he likes. He needs to keep a bit of a low profile, though, so he will stay out of sight when we have clients in camp, eh? I know that each of you will respect that."
Each man nodded soberly at his boss's request.
"James, it's our honor to have you here, but we're going to put you to work. I want you to rest up and eat for the next few days, then you can go out scouting with Louis, and we'll make a plan from there."
"I appreciate it, Mr. Hastings."
"Rich, please, call me Rich. You ready for another beer?"
Reese had been around Australians and New Zealanders on multiple deployments and had come to respect their ability to consume quantities of alcohol that would put most men in the hospital. It became immediately apparent that this was a talent shared by his new African friends. After a few minutes, dinner was served for the five men at a dining table that looked like it could hold at least 20. This camp was primitive, but Rich made sure that it maintained an air of first-world civility, complete with white tablecloths, linen napkins, and crystal wine glasses that were kept full with a seemingly endless flow of South African pinotage. A salad of fresh vegetables was served along with a medium-rare fillet of some of the best meat Reese had ever tasted, which turned out to be eland. After surviving on a small supply of canned goods and fresh-caught fish for weeks, Reese's body was starving for vegetables and red meat. The food was amazing, and not just due to Reese's hunger. His host served him seconds and thirds from the family-style platter until Reese could not eat another bite. A waiter then brought out heaping portions of bread pudding, which he somehow found room to devour. The mood at dinner was laid back and friendly. The men whom Reese had just met treated him like an old friend and put him immediately at ease. The reserved confidence of those around the table reminded Reese of the men he'd worked with in the SEAL teams, a fact that helped dispel any nervous feelings regarding his new surroundings. As odd as it was, Rhys felt more at home in this faraway corner of the world than he had since before his last disastrous deployment and the events that followed. As it turned out, the PHs were natives of bordering Zimbabwe, a country that Rhys knew had a turbulent history. Rather than talking politics, they focused on the rivers, the terrain features, and the game of Nyasa, casually briefing Rhys on what to expect during his time on the reserve. They didn't ask any personal questions, though Rhys assumed that they already knew exactly who he was. Men like these were the last of the cowboys. They believed in personal freedom and had no desire to complicate their lives or anyone else's by reporting the surprise guest, a friend of their employer, to the authorities.
"Let's have a drink and talk, James," said Hastings, handing the younger man a glass of brown liquid, neat.
The PHs bid them both good night as Rich motioned for Rhys to follow him into the darkness outside the dining area. He led Rhys down a series of stone steps toward a small sitting area, illuminated by the dancing light of a blazing fire pit. The men took adjacent seats and stared silently at the fire for a moment.
"Africa Channel 1, we call it."
As Rhys's eyes adjusted to the darkness, he could see the reflection of the full moon on a river below. The sitting area was situated on a high bluff overlooking the river. He thought maybe he'd had too much to drink when he saw the silhouettes of elephants bathing in the reflective waters. "Are those elephants down there?"
"Yeah. Cows and calves."
"Do you guys hunt them here?"
"We hunt a few old bulls, but we don't do any hunting within a mile of camp. This area is safe for them, and they know it. Have you spent much time in the bush, James?"
"I did a lot of hunting with my dad and grandfather when I was a kid, but haven't done much lately. Rafe and I hunted as much as we could in college in Montana, deer and elk mainly. We obviously hunted with you in Zim that time I came to visit. I also spent some time up in Kodiak, Alaska, in the Navy, and hunted every chance I got. I loved it up there."
Rich nodded.
"It's tough to find the time when you're busy doing what you and Rafe were doing for the past decade."
"Did you fight with Rafe's dad?"
"Not together, no. His dad, Jonathan, was my older brother. He was the reason that I became a soldier. He was 8 years older and joined the army before the war really got kicking. Our father had served in the long-range desert group in the war and later in C Squadron in Malaya. I guess he was our inspiration to join the regiment."
"So, you were SAS? I thought Rhys's dad was a Seles scout."
"Oh, he was. We both were, actually. Though he was in longer. I studied the scouts when we were deep into our counterinsurgency efforts in Iraq. What an incredible time in special operations history. Ah, it was bloody fun, eh? We'd go out dressed like the enemy and trick them into thinking we were insurgents traveling into the area. Pseudo-operations, we called them. We had all of the passwords and knew their SOPs so we could talk the talk. I obviously couldn't get too close, no matter how much face paint I put on. They'd show us where all of the Turs were hiding, and then we'd call in the Saints.
They're the cavalry?"
"Indeed. The RLI, the Rhodesian Light Infantry. They'd parachute or chopper in and sweep up the enemy in fire force ops. I'd be on the high ground with a radio guiding them in. It was tremendously effective."
Rhys was too young to have had any real perspective on the politics of the Rhodesian Bush War, but there was no doubt that it involved some of the most effective counterinsurgency efforts the world had ever seen. He hoped that history would remember his own men's bravery and tactical acumen, rather than whether they fought for Iraq's oil or Afghanistan's lithium. He also knew what it was like to fight an enemy whose PR machine was agile and relentless.
"We fought hard, but in the end it came down to politics. I still think about the boys we lost, both white and black. What do you say we drink one for those boys and their widows?"
Rhys looked Rich in the eye and extended his glass. "To them." the brave ones. Both warriors sat in silence for several minutes, each paying respect to their fallen brothers. Rhys cleared his throat and said, "How did you end up here in Mozambique, Rich?"
"Well, you were there in Zim. You saw them harass us."
"I remember it well. Did that start as soon as Mugabe took over?"
"Not right away, no. It was all pretty civilized at first. Bob and his crew were stealing everything they could, of course, but they left us alone for a while. Mugabe sent his 5th Brigade, men trained by the North Koreans, to slaughter his rival tribe, the Ndebele, and the world paid no attention. They tortured, starved, and shot them by the thousands. No one even knows how many they killed, but it was something upwards of 20,000 people. All civilians, men, women, children, and all because they belonged to the wrong tribe. Where was the international outrage then? Anyway, once they realized that no one gave a shit about what happened inside Zimbabwe, they started taking our farms and anything else that had any value. My brother was smart. He left as soon as the war was over and took his family to the Cape. He started with fuck all and made himself a bloody fortune. When things started to turn in South Africa, he did the smart thing again and moved to the U.S.
Yeah, I met Rafe not long after that.
That's about right. What year was it that you visited us?
1998. It was the summer before my senior year in college. I'll never forget it. That place was so beautiful.
It was that. Anyway, I stayed on the farm as long as I could. My family had spent decades building it, and I wasn't about to let the war vets poach all of those animals. I stayed for them, really. It got bad for a couple years after your visit, so I sent the family down south to live to get them away from the violence. They'd seen enough of that. When our farm was burned in 2000, I knew it was over. I took what I could and bid on a concession in Botswana, where we hunted for about 10 years. After they shut down hunting there, we found this place. Pretty damn ironic to be back in Moz, where I did so much fighting.
So you're a man without a country.
You know how that feels, don't you, James?
Rhys paused, staring into the fire. He nodded and took another long sip of his drink.
Chapter 20. Rhys was walking in downtown Coronado when he saw Lauren and Lucy shopping on the opposite side of the street. Lauren was combing the sidewalk sale rack of a boutique for bargains, and Lucy stood next to her, holding on to the strap of her purse. Turning, she saw Rhys across the street, her face lighting up with joy. He waved and began to make his way between two parked cars to cross the street. Lucy let go of Lauren's purse and began to run in his direction. Then everything went into slow motion. Rhys could see the taxi and knew that the driver wouldn't see Lucy until it was too late. Lucy's path and speed put them on a perfect collision course. Rhys yelled at the top of his lungs for her to stop, but no one could hear him, not Lucy, not Lauren, not the cab driver. Lucy kept coming, as did the taxi. Rhys began to run toward her, but his legs felt like they were mired in concrete. He'd never get there in time. He looked at the taxi driver and recognized the face of a man he'd last seen before putting two bullets into his brain on the streets of L.A. "It can't be." When he turned his head, Lucy's smile was the last thing he saw as the cab accelerated to make impact. Soaked in sweat, Rhys shot up in bed and looked at his strange surroundings. A tiny voice came through the thatched wall to his right.
"Morning. Morning, sir." Yep. I'm up,"
was all Rhys could muster in response, remembering that he was thousands of miles from Coronado, and that Lauren and Lucy were gone forever. The hangover hit him like a sledgehammer. There was no tumor to blame for this one, just too many beers, a lot of red wine, and more than a few whiskeys. He flung the blanket off his legs and swung his legs over to the floor, Struggling to find his balance, he stumbled into the bathroom. The figure that gazed back at him from the bathroom mirror looked like a homeless guy selling drugs at a music festival. He wasn't sure about drinking the water, so he threw on a pair of shorts and a t-shirt along with some flip-flops and staggered toward the dining area in search of coffee. Even in his current state, he was struck by the beauty of the African sunrise. The orange ball emerging over the treetops bathed the entire scene in a warm glow. The green forest was broken by the deep, sandy riverbed below, where he could see Cape Buffalo and what looked like kudu drinking. He assumed correctly that giant crocodiles were somewhere in the water below, waiting patiently for one of the mammals to venture too close. "How's it?" Rhys turned to see Louis walking diagonally toward the common area.
"Hope Rich didn't bore you with too many of his stories from the good old days?"
Louis smiled.
No, it was great. "Just wish I'd drank less."
Join the club. Let's get you some coffee."
Rhys followed Louis toward what would likely be a steady stream of caffeine consumed over many hours. Hastings was already seated at the breakfast table when they entered, a coffee mug in his hand and a large topographical map spread before him.
"Good morning, James. What are you doing up? I thought you'd sleep for days."
"This guy is pretty cheery for as much as we drank last night."
"Yes, sir. Good morning to you as well. I'm good, but I'll be better as soon as I get some coffee in me.
Thank you again for last night. Dinner was great, and I enjoyed our talk."
"Ah, I get kiddied away with the bloody politics. Get some coffee and rest up today."
"If it's all the same with you, I think it would be good for me to get out and about."
"Understood. Then come have a look at the map. I'll give you the lay of the land."
Rhys filled a mug from an old-fashioned urn and added some sugar and cream, a bit disappointed that there was no sign of honey. He took a seat next to Rich and tried to focus his blurry vision on the map in front of him.
"This, as you know, is the Nyassa Reserve. We hunt this block here."
Hastings outlined the boundaries with his thick, tanned finger.
"We just finished the paperwork to take over this neighboring block, which will more than double the size of our concession. We are going to be busy with clients over the next few months, and we need you to help scout the new block, if you're up for it."
"Sure, I'd be happy to.
I can't promise that I'll know what I'm looking for, but I'll give it a shot." "You'll have a couple of trekkers with you. They know the game better than anyone. They just don't have a sense of the big picture. Neither of them can read or write very well either, so I can't rely on them to give me much of a report. There's an old camp here on this river. Check it out and let me know what kind of shape it's in. After that, the three of you can spend a few weeks seeing what we've got for animals out there. Just having you moving around will help with the poaching. You'll probably run across some snares, and you may even bump into some poachers in the block. I know you can handle yourself if that's the case. We'll give you a vehicle and you'll need a proper rifle, which I've got for you."
"Check. What can you tell me about the poachers?"
"Ah, yes. Two lots of them, really. The first are after bushmeat. They put out wire snares, thousands of the bloody things. Some are looking for meat to sell in the villages, but a large number of them are conscripted to feed the Chinese mining and lumber operations that are popping up all over the country. The damn snares don't know the difference between an impala ewe and a lion. We counter them in two ways. One, we patrol constantly and pick up every snare we see and destroy it. We even pay bounties for them. The other way we do it is outreach. We try to employ as many locals as we can here in the camp or out in the field, and we distribute a good bit of meat to the villagers. The staple of their diet is mealie meal. You'd call it grits. Ground-up corn that they cook into a slop. They're all protein-starved, so we make sure that everyone gets a piece of what we shoot in the unit. If they help protect the game can provide for them. Sustainable is such a bloody greeny word, but that's what this is if we do it right."
"Sounds like everyone wins that way," Rhys said. "What about the second group of poachers? Guessing they feed the Asian black market?"
"Exactly. The Chinese are raping Africa blind for her resources.
They come in and make deals with the corrupt officials and mine whatever they want. It's all economic for them. There's zero return for the communities. Where's Jimmy Carter now? Sorry, I'm getting political again. As part of that Chinese presence, the demand for ivory and rhino horn has a direct line to the source. We've seen sophisticated poaching syndicates often in bed with the game departments all over Africa. We don't have any rhino here, so they're mainly after elephants. You won't see any Chinese in the field, but they're pulling the strings. The ivory gets smuggled out, along with all of the other resources, to feed the demand back in Asia. Sounds similar to the drug problem in the U.S. As long as there is a demand, the cartels will provide the supply. With the demand from Asia turning the tide on the supply side, will be tough. Right you are, James, unfortunately. Right you are.
Chapter 21. Basel, Switzerland. March. Colonel Andrenov reviewed the spreadsheets on his screens and offered a rare smile. The string of terrorist attacks and his investment strategies in advance of them had been far more successful than even he could have imagined. He knew, of course, that the retail markets would decline sharply out of consumers' fear of terrorism, timed perfectly with the holiday shopping season. His problem was spreading that fear and panic to the United States, where no kinetic attacks had taken place. His solution came thanks to a group that called itself the Syrian Electronic Army. This group of pro-Assad hackers took over the Associated Press's Twitter account in June 2013 and posted an erroneous breaking news headline about an explosion at the White House that had wounded the president. Despite the lack of an explosion, the U.S. stock market lost $136 billion in equity value in just 5 minutes. As a Russian national with plenty of capital, Andrenov had access to his choice of hackers and bot accounts. For a few thousand euros worth of cryptocurrency, his hackers had been carefully coordinating false reports of terrorist attacks at shopping malls and other retail locations across North America and Europe, keeping the Western world constantly on edge. As shoppers stayed home, brick-and-mortar stores had lost out on the holiday income that usually put them in the black for the year. The ordinarily chaotic shopping scenes on the Friday after Thanksgiving had been replaced by empty retailers whose shelves stood piled with unsold merchandise. Instead of flocking to movie theaters and restaurants over the holidays, consumers sat at home and fed on the fear stoked by the 24-hour news media. The ripple effect was felt across nearly all sectors of the economy as demand fell. This was all a predictable result of Andrenov's carefully planned operations, but the second element was pure luck. Over the past 2 decades, investors had exponentially increased their use of exchange-traded funds, ETFs. These securities offer investors a vehicle by which to profit from commodities, currencies, futures, and other goods without actually owning or taking possession of those items. For example, a gold ETF allows an investor to profit from an increase in the price of gold without buying actual gold. When the stock markets in New York, London, and across the globe declined sharply after the Kingston market attack, it set off a demand for cash. The problem was that many of the ETFs that had become so popular lacked any true liquidity. They were built on investor confidence rather than actual value. As that confidence shattered, so did the value of the funds. A gold ETF that owned very little actual gold bullion became a nearly worthless investment as institutions and individuals scrambled to cash out. The ETF bubble took the market by surprise, just as the housing bubble had done a decade earlier. The entire system collapsed like a trillion-dollar house of cards, catalyzing what would have been a small recession into an event that surpassed the 2008 financial crisis in terms of lost wealth. Hard-working people saw their 401ks evaporate and their pension plans become nearly insolvent. Retailers who were already teetering on bankruptcy thanks to online sales
shut their doors and laid off tens of thousands of workers. There was a worldwide contraction of credit that stifled growth to a standstill. Everyone, wealthy and poor, suffered. Everyone, that is, but Vasily Andreyev. He had shorted the equity markets in the United States, the United Kingdom, and across the European Union months before the attacks. That news alone had caused some uncertainty in the market, since he was viewed as such a savvy, if shadowy, investor. Instead of looking to the world like the profiteering terrorist mastermind that he was, he came out looking like an oracle, the kind of mind that could lead a nation out of decline. Andreyev pulled a tattered volume from the vast collection of first editions in his opulent library. Published in Russian, it was known to most of the world as The Protocols of the Elders of Zion. It was the only relic of the life of his maternal grandfather, a man he'd never met. His mother spoke of her father with awe, influencing young Vasily deeply with the political beliefs of a generation past. Unlike Andreyev's father and grandfather, who were devout communists, his mother's father had been an outspoken supporter of Imperial Russia. He was a member of the Black Hundreds, an ultra-nationalist society that espoused a motto of orthodoxy, autocracy, and nationality. The Black Hundreds despised anything and anyone who would challenge the House of Romanov, communists, Jews, and Ukrainian nationalists. The Black Hundreds had fought to suppress Ukrainian language and culture in Odessa, of all places, a feat that Andreyev planned to repeat. Capitalism had defeated the communists. Andreyev's attack on the world economies had punished the international bankers, and the next phase of his plan would finish the Ukrainians for good. A century after the fall of the empire, Andreyev would rebuild what his grandfather fought so hard to protect.
Chapter 22. Nyasa Game Reserve, Mozambique, Africa, March. After a hearty breakfast and three cups of coffee to get Reese's brain back in gear, he followed Rich toward the parking area. Rich reached behind the seat of his safari vehicle and retrieved a battered canvas rifle case that he handed to the new arrival. "You can use this rifle. It's old, but it works." Reese unzipped the case and pulled the big bore rifle out to inspect it. It was an old Mauser sporting rifle that looked like it had been carried to the moon and back. The bluing was worn from every visible surface from years of honest use, leaving the steel a burnished silver. The scarred walnut stock was the color of dark chocolate, and only small areas of the checkering at both the grip and forend remained visible. There wasn't a speck of rust or dirt, though, making it obvious that the rifle was heavily used, but never abused. Reese noticed some lettering at the top of the barrel that read, W.J. Jeffrey & Company, 60 Queen Victoria Street, London. It wore several proof marks, presumably from a house in England, and was marked 404 EX Cordite. He slowly cycled the bolt, which was as smooth as glass, pushing a cigar-sized round into the chamber. "How many does it hold?"
"Three down, one up the pipe. The 404s are too bloody wide for the standard Mauser, but this one feeds like a charm. A gunsmith down in Pretoria took the sides out of the mag box to give it more room, so the rounds actually ride on the wood. I've got a couple of extra boxes of ammo for you, along with a pouch for your belts."
Rich dug around behind the seat and handed Reese a handful of battered yellow and red cardboard boxes with Kynoch 404 Jeffery 400 grain solid printed on the front.
"All solid bullets?" Reese asked.
"Yeah. If you shoot this thing, it means that something is trying to stomp you into jelly. A solid is what you'll want. The softs won't penetrate on something like an Ellie. If you shoot an Impala or Warty for the pot, the solid will wreck less of the meat."
Reese nodded in understanding.
"Carry this thing everywhere when you're not in camp, eh?" You go off to have a shite and a dagger boy with a snare round his leg might decide to have a go at you, right?
Hastings laughed. No sling?
When bad things happen out here, they happen fast. You want your rifle in your hands, not on your back.
Understood. How's the recoil?
Ah, not bad. The bloody English knew how to shape a stock, which helps. It's like a heavy shotgun load. Nothing a big, tough frog man can't handle.
Is there somewhere I can test fire it?
Sure. Louis will stop outside of camp on the way out this morning, and you can have a go with it. Grab whatever you need from your room. He's gassing up the truck and will be ready to go in a bit. He'll have a cold box with food and drinks. Just take whatever you need for the day.
Got it. Thanks, Rich. I really appreciate this. Reese held up the rifle and nodded toward it.
No worries, eh? Can't have a new friend getting stomped on his first day. Take the case, too. You'll want it for the truck.
Back in his room, Reese searched through his duffel to find the items he thought he'd need as a professional, well, whatever he was now. The temperatures were already rising to the point of being uncomfortable, so he wouldn't need much in the way of clothing. He found a tan ball cap with an old platoon logo on it and traded his flip-flops for socks and his Salomon hiking boots, which admirably looked none the worse for wear, considering what they'd been through. He clipped a folding knife onto the pocket of his shorts and put his backpack on the bed to take inventory of what was inside. He pulled out several items that he wouldn't need for this excursion and made sure that both his binoculars and camera were packed. He slipped the boxes of 404 ammunition into an outside pocket and zipped up the bag. Grabbing his Gator's sunglasses from the small bedside table, Reese picked up his rifle and headed toward the parking area. Louis was standing by a white Toyota Land Cruiser pickup, the workhorse vehicle for most of the underdeveloped world, supervising the loading of supplies while he smoked a cigarette. He spotted Reese approaching with his gear and nodded.
"Mind if I throw my stuff in the back? Just hand it to Moosey, eh? You can put it up front if you'd prefer. Hand him your rifle, too. He'll put it up in the rack."
Reese handed his cased rifle to the thin black man in coveralls who appeared to be in his 50s. Moosey placed the rifle in the rack behind the rear window with deliberate respect.
"Do I need to get some water?" Reese inquired, still suffering a bit from last night's bender.
"No, we've got plenty in the cold box. Moosey, ipa iye diridza."
Moosey opened the cooler and handed down a 1-liter bottle of water. Reese nodded and thanked him.
"What language is that?"
"It's Shona. Moosey is from Zim. He's been my tracker as long as I can remember. He's like an uncle to me. He understands English well, but it's more efficient for us to speak in Shona. Most of the workers in camp speak the local tribal language as well as Swahili and a little English or Portuguese."
Reese nodded.
"Okay, looks like we're packed up, eh? You can jump up front with me. Moosey will ride in the back."
Reese noted a padded seat mounted behind the cab of the truck that would give the tracker a bird's-eye view as they drove. The Land Cruiser was a left-hand drive pickup with a standard floor shift. Though it was probably only a few years old, judging by the appearance, its lack of modern features made it appear to be from the 1970s. These stripped-down utility vehicles were virtually indestructible, but were also all but unobtainable in the United States. Reese had always loved using them overseas due to their dependability. Moosey tapped on the sheet metal roof and Louis started the motor, slipping the truck into gear. Three thin black men in olive-green coveralls were walking toward the camp on the narrow dirt track as the truck left the parking area. Louis steered the truck toward them and slammed on the accelerator. The men laughed and feigned fear as they scattered over the rocks that bordered the road. Louis waved and said something that Reese couldn't understand as they passed. They drove with the windows down, fresh air filling the cab.
"All right. You've seen the camp, and Rich gave you the lay of the land on the map this morning. Today we're going to take a bit of a drive to the new block and check out some spots for buffalo, so you can start to learn your way around the concession."
"Sounds good. This place is beautiful."
"It really is special. Moses is backward as hell, but there's so much potential. The wilderness areas are huge, and the animals are really starting to recover from the war. If we can keep the poaching under control, this place will be paradise."
"What do you do with poachers?"
Well, half the time you run into a couple of guys that you know are up to no good, but you can't prove anything. We try to catch them with snares or guns, but if we don't, we basically try to scare them. We tell them that we know what they're doing, and if we catch them out here again, they're going to jail. If we catch anyone in the act, we call in the game scout and let him handle it. Rich wants to build a dedicated anti-poaching unit, but that's expensive and we'd have to fund it ourselves. It'll be worth it, but after buying this new block, I think it's a matter of resources. Maybe if you stick around long enough, you can help us train them, eh? Happy to help if I can. Who do the game scouts work for? They work for the government, for the game department. In most of Africa, you have to have a game scout with you when you hunt with clients. They make sure that the laws are followed and all of that. A good one is a real blessing, eh? But a bad one can fuck up a hunt right quick.
So, it's like taking the game warden hunting with you?
Exactly. We pay for them, of course, but we don't pay them directly because they don't want them to have a conflict of interest. They take tips from the clients, though, so it's not exactly perfect in that regard.
Are they competent?
Ha! This is Africa, James. You never know what you'll get. Some of them are as good as the trackers, but some come straight out of the cities and you have to keep them from getting lost. They're given AK-47s, but no training, so you just hope they don't shoot you in the bloody back by mistake when you're on a track. Sounds like half of the Iraqi army. I bet. Speaking of that, I hope Rich didn't talk your bloody ears off about the Bush War last night.
Not at all. I'd never heard most of that before.
Did he tell you about his sister?
No, he didn't mention her. I thought it was just Rich and his brother.
It is now. They had a sister. She'd be Rafe's aunt. I never knew her, but I know the story. She was an air hostess for Air Rhodesia. The terrorists shot down two flights back in the late 1970s using Russian missiles. She was on one of them. They killed something like 40 people when the plane went down. Then they hunted down the survivors and killed them on the ground. All civilians, women, kids. They bragged about it on TV afterward. Sick bastards.
No wonder he's bitter.
Yeah. Those guys fought a tough fight, but it's over, and some of them have a hard time letting go. It's never going to be like the old days, no matter how much they complain. Rich is a lekker bloke, but sometimes he lives in the past. It's an African thing, I guess. Louis's eyes narrowed as he took a long drag on his smoke. In Afghanistan, they're still using us to settle centuries-old grievances every chance they get. Well, perhaps it's a human thing then, eh? Louis took his foot off the accelerator and slowed the truck as they approached a wide spot in the dirt road. He turned off the track and steered the truck so it was perpendicular across the red dirt path.
Looks like a good spot to test that new rifle of yours.
Let's do it. Reese opened his door and Muzi passed the 404 down from the bed. Louis said something in Shona and Muzi climbed down from the truck holding a panga, a utilitarian blade that was the African version of the machete. Reese retrieved his pack and laid it on top of the hood so that he could use it as a rifle rest. Louis handed him a rolled-up jacket to support the butt end. Muzi had walked 50 or so yards down the road and looked back toward them for approval. Louis flashed a thumbs up and Muzi used his panga to slash the bark away from a tree along the roadside, exposing the light-colored wood underneath. Reese now had a target. Reese expected Muzi would retreat to their position for safety, but instead, he walked a few yards off to the side and stopped.
"Go ahead and give it a go," Louis said, his binoculars already focused on the makeshift target.
"When in Rome, I guess."
Reese checked to ensure that a round was chambered and arranged Louis's jacket underneath the toe of the stock before leaning across the hood with the rifle. The back of his hand that gripped the forend rested on his back. He moved the safety to fire, found the silver front bead, and began to control his breathing. It occurred to him that the past weeks had been the longest period in 2 decades that he'd gone without firing a weapon either in training or in combat. He centered the bead in the express-style rear notch and arranged the sights on the target downrange, his eyes dancing between the 3 visual planes. He transitioned his focus to the front sight, exhaled slowly, and began to apply pressure on the trigger.
Boom!
The recoil was significant, as was the noise, and Reese was instantly reminded of his lack of hearing protection by the report of the elephant gun. He worked the bolt as the recoil pushed him rearward and chambered a new round as he returned his sights to the target. He saw Muzi move toward the tree and he moved his finger away from the trigger. Muzi used the tip of his panga as a pointer and indicated the bullet's point of impact, like the judge at a turkey shoot. The rifle's sights were zeroed perfectly.
"Good shot. You want to give it another one?"
"Sure, can't hurt.
You have any earmuffs by any chance?"
"Ha, yes, mate. Loud, eh?" Louis dug around behind the seat and returned with a pair of red earmuffs that he handed to Reese. He put them on and settled back in for a second shot, one that landed less than 2 inches from the first. Satisfied, Reese reloaded the rifle from the box of ammo in his pack. Muzi nodded at Reese approvingly as he took the rifle, returning it to the truck's rack. They drove on through miles of dense miombo forests broken occasionally by rivers or open savannas, with giant stone monoliths towering upward from the otherwise gentle terrain. Reese took it all in, awed by its savage beauty. The game appeared to be plentiful. Small groups of giraffes could be seen close to the road, their necks towering above the tree line like periscopes. Ever the guide, Louis would stop the truck and allow Reese to take in the scene while he passed along some knowledge about the species in question.
"You can tell a male from a female by looking at the antenna up top, eh? Like a human, the bulls go bald on top, and sometimes you can see where they've bent them from fighting. See how the antenna are crooked on the dark one on the left?"
Reese found the correct bull in his binoculars and took note of the askew headgear.
"I see what you're talking about. Why is that?"
"They fight for dominance by binging their heads together sideways. When they do it, they'll often break something on the skull and those things get crooked. Must give them a headache, eh?" After a few moments, Louis started the truck again and continued on their journey. Similar stops were made to observe groups of impala, zebra, and a small herd of Cape buffalo. Unlike in the touristy photo safari camps that Reese had seen on television, these animals didn't stand around very long once the vehicle stopped. It reminded him of the difference in animal behavior in places like Yellowstone versus the backcountry wilderness areas where he'd hunted during his college days in Montana. About 2 hours into the drive, Reese heard a tapping sound on the truck's roof, and Louis brought the truck to a halt. He exchanged words with Muzi and Shona for a moment before opening the door.
"Muzi sees big bull tracks. Elephant. Let's go have a look."
By the time Reese was out of the truck, Muzi was already handing Louis his weapon, a massive double-barreled express rifle with bores that looked at least a half-inch wide. Muzi handed Reese his rifle next before climbing down from the truck's bed. Louis and Muzi stood over a large circular track on the dirt road, Muzi pointing at it while speaking rather animatedly in his native tongue. The PH knelt by the footprint and pointed out the various characteristics to Reese.
"This is from a bull's front foot. We can tell because it's round. The rear track is more of an oval. These wrinkles are like a fingerprint. Every alley is different. This smooth spot here comes from the back of his foot, so we know which direction he's moving. See how worn this track is? This is an old bull. Probably a big one. Definitely worth having a look at."
Reese nodded as he took mental note of Louis's explanation.
"Muzi will lead the way. Just stay behind me. Stop if I..."